Have you ever noticed that we don't even try to teach human beings some of the most important skills in life? Who taught you how to walk? Did you take perambulating 101 in preschool? As a one-year-old, did you attend lectures on how to fall for fun and profit? I'm being facetious, of course. It's one of my best things. We don't teach our little ones to walk or even to crawl. It's pretty much up to them to figure it out, whether they're 9 months old or 12 months old or 15 months old or 18 months old or however old they are. And we don't try to teach our children how to think either. Now, I guess there are some educators and some psychologists who research this kind of thing, but most parents never really give this any attention. Most parents simply encourage their children to think, would ya? Without ever really explaining the process. You heard about the mom who was encouraging her 8-year-old to think. And one day he came and told her that he could make an ice cube melt by concentrating on it and thinking, melt, melt, melt. But it took longer than he thought it would. One of the abilities that children seem to learn on their own without really being taught, one of the skills that really is a component of thinking, of learning, is the ability to compare and contrast. Much of what we learn by figuring out that this is not like that, but that is like that. These three things are yellow, but that is red. Or these two things are round, and that's triangular. These are the kinds of questions that educators use to determine basic human intelligence. Well, here in 1 Corinthians 13, Paul is trying to help the Corinthians learn to think. To think biblically. Trying to teach them how to figure out, if I can call it, basic spiritual intelligence. And he does this by comparing and contrasting spiritual gifts that they prized so highly and agape love. In verses 1 through 3 here of 1 Corinthians 13, Paul contrasts the value of spiritual gifts exercised with agape love versus spiritual gifts that are exercised without agape love. And then in his poetic description of agape in verses 4 through 7, Paul contrasts 8 negative statements about agape with 7 positive statements about agape. He tells us what agape love is not versus what agape love is. And as we come now to the final section here in this chapter, verses 8 through 13, Paul continues to compare and contrast spiritual gifts with agape love. So let's read these 5 verses before we begin, starting in verse 8. 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 8. Love never fails. But whether there are prophecies, they will fail. Whether there are tongues, they will cease. Whether there is knowledge, it will vanish away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect has come, then that which is in part will be done away. When I was a child, I spoke as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know just as I also am known. And now abide faith, hope, love, these 3, but the greatest of these is love. This morning we take up 2 contrasts in verses 8 through 10. First, spiritual gifts are temporary, But love is permanent. Spiritual gifts are temporary, but love is permanent. Verse 8 begins with the simple statement, love never fails. Now, give credit to the translators of the Old King James Version. That is a poetic conclusion to verse 7. I mean, just read it. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. That is just such a lyric ending to that sentence, isn't it? But unfortunately, the word that is translated fails here is an unusual word, and it's much more picturesque than simply fails. Like many of the 15 verbs that Paul uses in verses 4 through 7, this verb paints a picture. It means falls to the ground. It's autumn, and we see this word picture all around us. Trees are shedding their leaves, and they're falling to the ground. And of course, such leaves are no longer alive. They wither, and eventually they disintegrate, and they are no more. It's as if Paul is saying, look at the leaves falling from the trees. Agape love is not ever like that. Now, some of you may feel like I have forever ruined the poetry of 1 Corinthians 13:8. But it's vital that we understand that the statement, love never fails, is not about failure and success. When that verse says love never fails, God is not promising that love always succeeds. Not promising that. Dr. John MacArthur makes a comment on this word here that is spot on. Let me read it to you. I'm quoting, love is not a magic key that Christians use to unlock every opportunity and guarantee every endeavor. Love is not a spiritual formula that faithfully applied automatically fulfills our desires and produces human success. Love does not always win, at least not in the usual sense. Jesus Christ was love incarnate, yet he did not, by his perfect love, succeed in winning every person to himself. He was ridiculed, maligned, denied, rejected, and crucified. Unquote. I'm afraid that way too many couples come to the marriage altar, and this is the passage of Scripture that they want read, and when they hear that phrase, love never fails, they think, well, we've got it made because we're in love. Rather, Paul is pointing out with this word that love is permanent. It will never fall like a dead leaf from a tree to the ground and decay and disintegrate and be no more. Let me flip this over and say it this way. Love is eternal. And it's eternal because that is the very nature of the eternal God. The eternal God is love. The eternal God is agape. And what nature does that eternal God give to all of his children? According to 1 John, when we become children of that eternal God, that loving God, then we take on that same kind of nature. And how long are we going to live? For all eternity, and therefore love is eternal. It never ceases. Now, this truth is actually very practical in the here and now. We invest in the eternal. We lay up treasures in heaven when we seek to cultivate agape love in our lives right now. So much of what we invest our time and our lives in right now is someday going to go up in flames. At that last day, when everything will be disintegrated in that last big bang, it's all going away, all that we've invested in. But let me tell you, when we invest ourselves in cultivating agape love in our lives, that will never go away. That will never be destroyed. That will never fall to the ground like a leaf. That's what Paul is telling us. You want to invest in something eternal? Invest in making sure that agape love is your operating system. Now, Paul contrasts the permanence of love with three spiritual gifts here in verse 8. Prophecy, tongues, and knowledge. Now, two of those, we know why Paul picked them. We know that the Corinthians were particularly interested in the most spectacular spiritual gifts, and so he talks about tongues. And we also know from the book of 1 Corinthians that the Corinthians were big on Bible knowledge. You know, Paul and Peter and Apollos had been their teachers, and so, you know, they kind of were puffed up with the Bible knowledge that they have, and so Paul here talks about knowledge. And then Paul, I think, adds one of his own. He adds prophecy to the list, and he adds prophecy to the list here because in the next chapter, we're going to get there in a couple of weeks, in chapter 14, he compares and contrasts the usefulness of prophecy with the usefulness of tongues. And so Paul even wants to talk about the top gift here, prophecy, the really, really valuable gift. And even that gift is temporary. Whether there be prophecies, they will fail. Whether there are tongues, they will cease. Whether there is knowledge, it will vanish away. Spiritual gifts will fail. Agape love will never fail. Spiritual gifts will fail. Now, with each of these three spiritual gifts here in verse 8, Paul uses a phrase, he uses grammar in the original language that can't really be fully translated into English. And this grammar kind of conveys an attitude. It's like, whether there are prophecies, they will fail. Whether there are tongues, they will cease. Whether there's knowledge, it'll vanish away. We have a word for this today in our culture. Have you diss somebody? You ever heard that word? Okay. I was going to look it up to see what it meant, but I think most of you understand. You know, you diss somebody. That's the idea here. Paul is dissing these spiritual gifts. Why? Because they're temporary. They're not even in the same league with agape love. Agape love is permanent. Agape love is eternal. Spiritual gifts? That's the idea. Now, Paul first of all speaks of prophecies. And I think he speaks first of prophecies because it's the most important gift that any Christian could get at that point. Because the gift of apostleship, which was really first in line, that was closed. There were no more apostles. So he speaks here of the foremost spiritual gift when he speaks of prophecy. And he says, whether there are prophecies, they will fail. Now here's what I want you to get. Everything I'm going to say for the next 10 or 15 minutes is founded on this one thing. So everybody's got to get what I'm about to say. When Paul said, whether there be prophecies, they will fail, that is a different word in the original language than the word that he used when he said, love does not fail. Different word. I have no idea why the New King James Version would take two different Greek words in the same sentence, in the same verse, and translate them by the same word in English. There ought to be a law against that. It's not enhancing our understanding. It's getting in the way of our understanding. Can you tell I'm a little bit hipped on this? Now, that word that's translated fails in our New King James Version, whether there be prophecies, they shall fail. That word is the key word in this passage. Okay? This isn't just a suitcase we need to unpack. This is a tractor trailer that we need to unpack. Okay? So we're going to step back for a minute and we're going to unpack the tractor trailer. Okay? So it's a little time out. Okay? Everybody relax. Take a deep breath. We're going to unpack this word. So that word that's translated fails there, whether there are prophecies, they will fail. That word means to be made inoperative or useless. To be made inoperative or useless. When I was a boy, we lived next door to a National Guard armory, which I always found kind of cool because there were always Jeeps right next door to my house. So, you know, you want to go out and play Army? You could go jump in a real Army green Jeep and play like you're in the Army. And it was really cool. What was even nicer about it was there were no Army guys around. Okay? Like 2 days a year, there would be like 1,000 guys there. And then you couldn't find parking for like 3 blocks. Because that's when they all were getting dropped off, you know, to go to camp. That only happened once a year. The rest of the time, like only 3 guys worked in the armory. And I found it to my advantage to make sure that I was friends with these guys because the armory primarily was just a big gymnasium on the inside, you know, with basketball goals. So I was like my own personal gymnasium. You know, I would go over and ask these guys, you know, can I use the gymnasium? And a lot of times they would let me. They were nice guys. And in particular, there was a staff sergeant there named Max who obviously wanted to be my friend. So, you know, Max gave me, you know, patches like, you know, sergeant stripes and stuff like that. And patches that were from different divisions and groups and stuff. And I still have all these patches somewhere. But the thing that Max gave me that I really prized was he gave me a hand grenade. Believe me, I still have that hand grenade. Now, you have to be asking yourself, this must be Mad Max. He's giving a 10-year-old kid a hand grenade. How could Mad Max give a 10-year-old kid a hand grenade? He did it because it had been made inoperative. The explosive had been taken out of the hand grenade. They actually used these for guys to practice throwing hand grenades. And so they weren't live. The explosive had been taken out. They had been made inoperative. That's what this word means. Now, in addition, this verb is in the future tense. That means that prophecies had not been made inoperative at the point where that Paul lived. This event would happen at some future moment. And we will talk more about when that exact moment is to occur. We'll talk about that later. Then this verb is also in the passive voice. I know this is way too much English for many of you, but stick with me, okay? Because we're not actually talking about English, we're talking about Greek, which makes it way cooler. So the verb is in the passive voice. And the idea here is that prophecies will not become inoperative of themselves. They will not make themselves inoperative. Something or someone will act upon prophecies to make them inoperative. And of course, that will happen at some point in the future. And then one more very important point regarding this key word. It's a key word here because the same word in the original is used of knowledge at the end of verse 8. Whether there is knowledge, it will become inoperative. It says it will vanish away. Where did that come from? It's the same word. Whether there is knowledge, it will become inoperative. But I'm not finished yet. This same verb, this same key word is used a third time in this passage at the end of verse 10. That which will be in part will be done away is the translation there, but it's the same verb. It will become inoperative. So here, I want to give you an expanded, consistent translation, okay? So I want you to look in your Bibles. I want you to read along with me. And I'm going to give you an expanded, consistent translation of these verses. Love never falls to the ground. But whether there are prophecies, they will be made inoperative. Whether there are tongues, they will cease. Whether there is knowledge, it will be made inoperative. For we know in part and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect has come, then that which is in part will be made inoperative. Now, when we translate the verbs here consistently, it points up the fact that tongues is the odd man out here. Did you notice that? Verse 8 says that prophecy and knowledge will be made inoperative in the future. And again, verse 9 focuses right back on those same two gifts. For we know, that's the gift of knowledge, and we prophesy, that's the gift of prophecy. In part, and then what does verse 10 say about these partial gifts? It repeats that they will be made inoperative. But a different verb in the original language is used in verse 8 to describe what happens to the gift of tongues. So the Apostle Paul here puts tongues in a different category. Why does Paul do that? I am so glad you asked. Now, the verb here in verse 8 that is used to describe tongues is translated cease. And it means cease. But I want you to notice, it's also future. It will cease. But it is in the middle voice rather than the passive voice. Again, I know that's TMI, way too much information. It's actually WTMI. It's way too much information for some of you, but stick with me, okay? What that means is that tongues will not be made inoperative by something else acting on it. There will not be some external agent or some external event that will act on tongues to bring it to the place of being inoperative, to the place where it ceases. Rather, it will cease on its own. That's the idea here. It will cease of itself. There's something built into it that will cause it to cease on its own, kind of like a battery. You know, a battery is designed that it goes for a certain length of time, and then at some point it ceases, normally 2 days after Christmas. That's the idea here. Tongues are going to go for a certain length of time, and then on their own, because of the nature of the spiritual gift of tongues, they are going to cease. So, you have two categories here of spiritual gifts. All spiritual gifts are going to be temporary. All of them are going to become inoperative or cease. Agape love is permanent. Spiritual gifts are going to come to an end, okay? But spiritual gifts, there's two different categories. There's this category, and I think almost all spiritual gifts fall into this category, that there's some future event that is going to cause them to become inoperative. And we'll talk more about this, okay? But tongues is in a completely different category. Tongues on its own will cease. Now, you have to be thinking, okay, when will tongues cease? When will the battery run out? Well, if you've been here for the past few weeks, we've talked about this already. A few weeks back, we talked about the fact that the sign gifts came to an end at the end of the apostolic era. By the time the last apostle had died, the gift of tongues had ceased on its own. Now, let me share some thoughts with you. I didn't come up with these myself. I got them from a commentary, but I think some of this is important for me to share to you. I know it's a little detailed, but you need to understand that down through church history, you just don't find tongues. From 200 AD to 1900 AD, tongues is not there except in heretical groups. In some of the heretical groups, you read about there being tongues, but in mainstream Christianity, it's not there. And listen to what we find in the early leaders of the church, okay? So Clement of Rome was one of the earliest church leaders after the apostles. He wrote a letter to the Corinthian church in 95 AD. So 1 Corinthians was written in about 52 AD. So this is like 40 years, a little more than 40 years after 1 Corinthians was written, Clement writes this letter to the Corinthian church discussing, again, problems in the church. And guess what? He never mentions tongues. Wow. Remember, this is the only church in the New Testament where we hear anything about tongues. And 40 years later, this leader writes a letter to them, doesn't even mention it. A apparently it had ceased by that point. Justin Martyr was a great leader in the church in the second century. This would have been in the 100s AD. He visited many of the churches of his day, and he wrote extensively, and yet in none of his writings does he ever mention tongues. In his writings, he has several lists of the spiritual gifts, and he never includes tongues. Origen was a brilliant church scholar who lived in the 3rd century, which would have been the 200s AD. He explicitly argues that sign gifts, like tongues, were temporary, that they ceased at the end of the apostolic age, and they were not being exercised in the 200s AD by the church. And then finally, the most prolific writer in the early church was a guy named John Chrysostom. We have many, many of his sermons. He lived from the 340s AD to 400 AD. Writing on 1 Corinthians, he states that tongues and the other miraculous sign gifts had ceased. So, Paul tells us here, the gift of tongues will cease on its own. When will it cease, Paul? Well, Paul wasn't around to tell us, but the early leaders in the church pretty much make it clear that it had died out by 95 AD. Another way that we know this is by a chronological study of the New Testament. Now, this is difficult, okay? Can anybody tell me what the first book in the New Testament to be written was? I don't know. Okay? Probably if I, had a doctorate in New Testament studies, I would know all this stuff, but I don't know. See, we don't have our books in the New Testament in the order in which they were written. You really have to dig to find out what the order of the books were. Like, you wouldn't know that 1 Thessalonians was written before 1 Corinthians. Because the New Testament is ordered based on topic, not based on chronology. But if you bother to go to the difficulty of looking at the New Testament as to when each book was written, tongues was only mentioned in the books that were written early in the New Testament era. How many books in the New Testament mention tongues? I mean, the Pentecostals will tell you it's like 27. But no, how many books in the New Testament mention tongues? 3. Paul mentions it in only one book, 1 Corinthians. John never mentions it. Peter never mentions it. Luke, who was the historian of the early church, of course, he mentions it because of Pentecost. And so when you study this, and by the way, after Acts 19, we never hear of tongues again in the history of the early church. So when you look at this chronologically, understanding what Paul says here in 1 Corinthians 13, the tongues will cease of themselves, you pretty much say, okay, Paul, I get it. By the time the New Testament was completed, by the time the apostles had finally died out, tongues had ceased on their own. The battery had run out. So, spiritual gifts are temporary. Some have already run out, like tongues. Others, there will be some other event that we're going to talk about that will make them inoperative that is yet future. But then Paul's argument here segues into a second contrast. Not only are spiritual gifts temporary, they are partial. We know in part, and we prophesy in part. Now, both of these phrases are pointing to spiritual gifts, to the spiritual gift of prophecy, to the spiritual gift of knowledge. I am not going to talk about what those spiritual gifts are right now. The hour grows late. I'm not going to dive down into that. But both of these gifts have to do with revelation. They have to do with God revealing Himself to man. And so there were gifts functioning in the church at this point, 52 AD, by which God revealed Himself through gifted individuals to the church. Now let me ask you, do we have any of that kind of stuff still around today? Where God had revealed Himself to the early church. Do we have any of that today? It's not functioning today, but we have some of the records of that today in what is called the New Testament. Okay? So the apostles and prophets and people who had the gift of knowledge, God was giving them revelation. He was revealing Himself to them and through them, and some of that got recorded, and we call it the New Testament. Now, the point that Paul makes about these gifts, and by extension, to some degree, it applies to the revelation that we have in the New Testament, is that they were limited. Verse 9 says, "For we know in part and we prophesy in part." The revelation and knowledge of God that we have through these gifts that comes down to us in the New Testament is partial. And it's partial in two ways, okay? Again, I'm not going to go into the fact that the words that are translated here in part, they give rise to the idea that this idea is twofold, okay? So first of all, this revelation that we have of God that's come down to us, at least in some parts in the New Testament, is partial, first of all, in that we know only part of what there is to know about God. Now, this shouldn't be a surprise to any of us. In Deuteronomy 29:29, it says, "The secret things belong to the Lord our God, but those things which are revealed belong to us and our children forever." We know what God has revealed to us in His Word, but there's still a lot of secret things that belong to the Lord that we don't know. The Apostle Paul says something similar in Romans chapter 11. He says, "Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are His judgments and His ways past finding out." There's a lot about God that we don't know, that we don't understand. Now, this truth, again, should not surprise any of us. God is infinite. It's not even possible that we as finite human beings, that our minds would even be able to comprehend an infinite God. You know, when I think about my mind trying to take God in, there's one word that always comes to mind. It's a good southern word. Puny. Our puny minds cannot possibly take in the infinity that is God. It's like the little kid at the beach digging a hole in the sand and going to the ocean and saying, "Mommy, Mommy, I'm gonna put the ocean in my hole." "Keep digging, kid. It ain't gonna happen." It doesn't make any difference how hard we try. We do not have the capacity to understand an infinite God. So our knowledge is partial in that sense. But then there's another sense in which the word partial here is used. And it has the idea we know part by part. We know one part over here and we know another part over there. And then we have to try to put those parts together. And the problem is that oftentimes the truth that I know over here and the truth that I know over there, they're competing truths. And I have to somehow figure out how these two truths go together. You know what I'm talking about? This happens all the time in the second service, doesn't it? I'll ask you guys a question, and somebody will say, well, this verse over here says this. And we think, well, yeah, well, then the answer must be X. And then we keep discussing it for a little while, and then somebody over here will say, well, you know, this verse says this. And then we think the answer must be C. And somehow we've got to put X and C together. And somehow connecting the dots isn't real easy. That's what our knowledge of God is like. Jesus is 100% God, and Jesus is 100% man. Yeah, how's that happen? I don't know, but somehow I'm going to put these two truths together. And you know what? The best that I can do is by simply saying Jesus is 100% God and Jesus is 100% man. You say explain, and I'll say Jesus is 100% God and Jesus is 100% man. Can you elaborate? Jesus is 100% God and Jesus is 100% man. That's about all I can do. This is the kind of revelation. This is the kind of knowledge we have. It's part by part. Now, what that means is that the knowledge that we have of God ought to make us humble. You see, I have certainty with regard to God. With regard to the things of God, I have certainty, but I have that certainty with a great deal of humility. I know of a certainty that Jesus is 100% man. I know of a certainty that Jesus is 100% God. I am certain of those things. But I am also certain that there's a lot that I don't understand because God hasn't revealed it yet. There are ways that those two things go together that haven't been revealed. See, here's the problem. What we don't know about God, we don't know. We don't know what we don't know. I know certain things about God, and I don't have a problem preaching those things. I know them. God's Word tells me this is so, and I stand on that truth. But I don't know what I don't know. Let me tell a story. Maybe you'll get it if I tell this to you in the form of a story. So here's a businessman from Korea, named, likely enough, Mr. Kim. Okay, so Mr. Kim has never been to the USA before, and he flies into Denver on a business trip. And Mr. Kim sits in the middle aisle, so as he's landing, even as he's coming in, he doesn't see anything of the U.S. And as he lands, poor Mr. Kim has a heart attack. So they slap him on a gurney. He still doesn't get to see anything. They put him in an ambulance. They take him to the hospital. You know, they give him open heart surgery, and there he is in the hospital for the next 3 weeks. So for the first week and a half of that, he's in bed. He can't get out of bed, and he can see out of the window just what he can from his hospital bed. And he sees that Denver is fairly flat with some rolling hills. And his wife calls him, you know. And she says, well, you know, what's it like there in Colorado? And he says, well, it's fairly flat. There's some rolling hills here. It's really pleasant. Now, does he doubt what he's saying? Is he certain about what he's saying? He's seen it with his own eyes. He's absolutely certain. Yes, it's, you know, fairly flat. There's some rolling hills here. That's what Colorado is like. Well, finally, he gets, you know, into his second week, to the end of his second week of his recovery, and he's able to get out of bed. And so a nurse takes him and walks him down the hall and out in an observatory, and for the first time, he sees the Rocky Mountains. And he says, "Oh, I may have given my wife the wrong impression." Do you get it now? We don't know what we don't know about God. I'm certain of what God has told me in His Word. And I have no problem preaching those truths with complete confidence. But I'm also humble enough to say, I don't know what I don't know. What we have, what has been revealed to us at this point through the apostles and through the prophets and through the gifts of the early church is partial. But someday I'm going to get the complete view. Someday they're going to wheel me out onto the observatory and I'm going to say, "Oh, the Rocky Mountains. Wow." Now, there is an event that will remedy this partial knowledge, and it's mentioned here in the last phrase of verse 10. We will know in part until that which is perfect has come. Now, obviously the key word here in that phrase is the word perfect. And many of you know that the word perfect, as it occurs oftentimes in the New Testament, doesn't mean without flaw. Rather, that word that's translated consistently in the Old King James and in our New King James as perfect, it comes from a root word that means goal. And so the word here that's translated perfect means something that has reached its goal. So, when has an acorn reached its goal? When is an acorn perfect? When it's a full-grown tree. When is a student perfect? When is a college student perfect? Never, okay. When he walks across that stage and gets the diploma, he's reached his goal. When is a Christian perfect? Not when he is sinless, not when he is without flaw, but rather when he reaches the goal that God has for him, which is spiritual maturity. Now, this passage talks about not the person that is perfect. That's not what it's talking about. It's talking about that which is perfect. And it says, when that which is perfect comes, what will happen? That's when spiritual gifts will be made inoperative. So there's an event that will in some way reach the goal of God's plan. That's how I'm going to put it. Someday the goal of God's plan will be reached. And when the goal of God's plan is reached, then spiritual gifts will no longer be necessary. They will become inoperative because of that event. Now, what is that event? Hold that thought. Because the word perfect here also has a second meaning. It's used here in verse 10 as the opposite of that which is partial. That which is perfect versus that which is partial. And so that which is perfect is talking about that which is complete. So there's coming a day, there's an event, again, at the fruition of God's plan, when the terminus, when the goal of God's plan is reached, there's an event at which our knowledge of God will finally be complete. Now, when is that event going to happen? Would you like to know when that event is going to happen? Come back next Sunday, and we will talk about it, okay? Unless you would like me to preach for another hour right now, come back next Sunday, okay? And we will talk about it. Now, let me conclude by saying, it's real easy to focus on the wrong thing. It's real easy to focus on the wrong thing in life. One of my responsibilities at Bob Jones University, I have no idea how I got this job. It is not on my job description. But I am the keeper of policy at Bob Jones University. Many of you did not know this, okay? So every policy that gets enacted at Bob Jones, even by the Board of Trustees, has to go through moi. So recently we have been talking about, yes, students, you can hear it, we have recently been talking about a revision to the academic probation policy. Now, one of the reasons for the academic probation policy is that when a student's GPA dips below 2.0, certain things need to kick in that student's life. And one of them is that their extracurricular activities get pulled way back. Because oftentimes, when a student's GPA dips below 2.0, it's an indication that they have focused on what? They have focused on extracurricular activities. And so that policy seeks to correct that. It's easy to do that very same thing in the Christian life. Let me ask you, what do many people focus on in the Christian life that we've been talking a lot about today? They focus on spiritual gifts. I've got a shelf full of books in my office about spiritual gifts. It's like, this is the focus. Let's focus on spiritual gifts. What's Paul telling us here? Spiritual gifts, they're temporary. Spiritual gifts, they're partial. Focus on agape love. That's the focus. Spiritual gifts are extracurricular activities compared to agape. Agape is the core curriculum. This is where we ought to be focused. So before you ever try to figure out what your spiritual gift is, try to figure out how you can implement agape love in your life, in the length and breadth of it. That's what Paul is teaching us here. What have you done in the last 2 or 3 weeks as we've been focused on agape love? What have you done to implement, to get agape love into your life as the standard operating process, procedure? Is this the operating system in your life? Where have you failed to get to the level of the agape love we've been talking about?